My name is Byron Swanson. We're talking about liberation theology this week. And today's topic is liberation theology, semicolon, is it biblical? So that's why we need the Bible. But before we do that, was everybody that's here today here yesterday also, so we don't need to review? By the way, would anybody mind pulling those two shades back there? There's a glare, and I can't see your faces. But are there any new people today who weren't here yesterday? Okay, so we'll take just a couple seconds to do a very quick review. And then those of you that might have been here yesterday and remember can sort of fill in the gaps later on or something. But we'll review first just 2-3 minutes on what a basic outline of liberation theology is. Then I'll talk to you about our agenda as far as getting into the biblical outlook. Liberation theology begins with the presupposition that certain people in this world, unfortunately a huge number, the majority of people in this world, for various reasons, are oppressed. They're poor. They are what we call marginal people, or what liberation theologians refer to as marginal people, non-persons, the wretched of the earth, and so forth. They're poor and oppressed for all sorts of reasons, maybe because of the color of their skins, maybe because of hunger or economics, or because of war or strife or imperialistic control and exploitation. And we have to admit that those of us that live in this country are guilty here, there, and maybe everywhere in adding to that. But anyway, they are here, the oppressed people. Women have been oppressed for thousands of years. Last night in the session, and one of the people that was here last time talked about being gay. Gay people have been oppressed for centuries and centuries and centuries, and they know what this means when you talk about beginning with oppression. Anyway, oppressed people in the last couple of decades have gotten together. And if you're Christian, it's the nice little group that, or the nomenclature that is used is called base Christian communities. This is especially true in Central America, where our focus is this week. And as they get together, their agenda is number one, and this outline again is so important because note that they don't start here, they start here. They get together and they read the Bible. And they look at it, as we're going to do today, trying to figure out as best they can what the Bible was saying back then, what it means for us now, and finally, what kind of action, what kind of praxis should we now go out into the world and practice to somehow let the Bible come alive and do something to alleviate the oppression that we find ourselves in. We're not going to talk about this today, but very quickly, just a quick review. This will be what we'll be doing the rest of the week. But the type of action that spins out of Bible reading is a study, a serious study of Marx, becoming political, becoming subversive, sometimes, certainly not always, becoming violent, talking existentialist language, and we won't take time now to go back and review that. And through it all, and perhaps this should be a summary of all, you're doing all these things to work for the advancement or the introduction of the kingdom of God on earth. And we'll come across some passages probably today that support that. Okay, that's our quick review. Any quick questions that anybody has? Those of you especially that were here yesterday and might have chewed on it a little bit or thought about it, anything? Yeah, we're going to pick up one thing. John, right? Okay. Just before class began, John had found an article in Newsweek about ecology, because you remember yesterday, because it was Earth Day or Environmental Day declared by the United Nations, I suggested that the newest type of liberation theology, really an exciting dimension, is that many people now are working for the liberation of the environment from those of us who are oppressing the environment. And John found an article in the, June 5th?
June 5th, Newsweek. Titled "A New Story of Creation," it's the season for a theology of ecology, and it was just real timely, considering you know that the United Nations Day is today. And I don't know if there's a photocopy machine up here, but I'll try to get a copy and post it on the bulletin board. It's kind of an interesting article. It describes the thinking of Father Thomas Berry, I think is back in New England, and his feelings about how Christianity so far has dealt with the issue of stewardship of the earth. Sort of thing. So if I can get a copy of it, I'll get it posted up. So you can,
yeah. What issue?
June 5th? June 5th, 1989.
Okay. I just wanted to say one thing about this. I meant to say it yesterday and I forgot it. The oppression, the oppressing thing about the oppression of the environment is that, unfortunately, even the most oppressed people in the world are also guilty of oppressing the environment. None of us are exempt. When we are in Central America, it is absolutely unbelievable. They are stripping the forest bare because they need wood for scraps to make houses, for wood to burn for the wood-burning stoves, which is all that they have. And they're depleting their land, and as a result, they're going through drought, as is, I guess, not Minnesota, but there you are. Nebraska, Kansas, and so forth, the whole world is being affected. I suppose maybe some of the same thing is going on in Brazil, where millions and millions of acres of the, rainforest are being devoured every day. But there again, you see how we oppressors, there I suppose it's the wealthy people who are moving in to make money, and as a result, we are oppressing the environment in that particular situation. But anyway, oppression is everywhere, and all of us are guilty. Even those who are oppressed are part of the oppression. Okay, now.
I have one basic question that I've just never heard addressed. What stops this from just keeping on going, that the oppressors will be the oppressed, and it just keeps changing?
Yeah. Anybody have an answer for that? It's a speculative question, of course, but it's an interesting one.
The thing I find is that no one wants to give up anything in order to save the environment. Mm-hmm. It doesn't matter which level of society, you know, we're all striving to get more. And no one wants to give up. I mean, who wants to give anything up to not have the coal-fired plant? No one.
That's right.
And so we're all greedy, and we're, you know, we're all selfish. Man's his own enemy.
Yeah. And what you've said about the environment, which is totally true. I live in Southern California with Los Angeles at my doorstep, and it's absolute gridlock. You can't drive, you can't breathe, you can't drink the water. You know, everybody has to have filtered water put into their house. It's an absolutely unbelievable situation, but none of us wants to give up our cars or pool rides or, you know, in any way do anything that's going to help the situation. Now, take what you said about the environment and add it to all these other areas of life. If I'm white, I don't want to give up my power over blacks. If I'm male, I don't want to give up my power over women. If I'm wealthy from the United States, I don't want to give up my economic power over the third world countries that don't have that same power.
Okay, doesn't it really come down to what Christ taught? You know, if we were doing what we were taught, we wouldn't be oppressing people. We wouldn't be using, have to have this power. We wouldn't have to have all these things. So man is his own worst enemy, and will probably someday destroy himself because he cannot limit himself.
Yeah. Okay, now that's the obvious conclusion that many people who have been oppressed for centuries have come to. You become filled with despair. You become hopeless. You look at the world and you say, there's no way that things are going to change. There's no way that improvement is going to be made. You sort of give up. And that's, again, the genius, or that's, again, the excitement of this revolution, which is called liberation theology, that people, by doing what we're going to do today, if we ever get to it, turning to the Bible, have found that hope, have found that excitement, have found the desire to go on believing with all their heart. I didn't write big enough, I'll try to do that again, that we can change the situation. We can make things better. There can be some sort of a realization of the kingdom of God on earth. And as we go down there, you know, for 3 years in a row now, I don't have that hope. I look at it and I come home just absolutely emotionally spent and physically spent. I'm just wrought with all sorts of despair. But these people, that's again that treasures in earthen vessels in this, whatever our theme is, the second part of it, the disparity thing, where we who have so much look at the situation and have no hope, they who have nothing look at the situation and have hope, and much of the credit has to go to liberation theology. Again, it is a, we're not a part of it, I don't understand it because I'm not poor, but it's happening. It is absolutely rocking the world, changing the theological scene.
Well, I don't know what you're saying, but it sounds like a revitalization of Christianity, because when Christ was here, you know, what, most of the civilized world were slaves, with no hope of anything. And these people, we don't have that name for them, but you know, what's the difference? They're essentially in a hopeless situation.
Yeah.
And that's why they're grasping onto it, and that's why Christianity spread way back then.
Great. Okay. One more comment. You rescind your...
Well, no, I was just going to say what's being said in one sense is we are approaching the inevitable, that we have to face up to the truth. And the truth is that we must share, we must be stewards, and humanity, not being perfect, I can put it in this way, I'm not sure that I really believe it, but let me put it this way. Humanity is such that it cannot tolerate the truth. It simply can't. It can't. If it had to live in total truth, I don't think they could accept it. Uh-huh. Then the other thing, with respect to pollution, the environment, and so on, even if we cut back to using half of what we're using right now, in a short time, population is doubling. So from the standpoint of the total resources, we're never going to get over that situation.
Mm-hmm.
Population will double. Well, my first recollection in school of the world population was a little over 2 billion. Here we are 6 billion right now.
Yeah, and growing fast.
It's growing faster than ever.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
At some point, there's going to be an ultimate, we'll have to face the ultimate truth.
Yeah, yeah. And that's again why this part is so important when you talk about liberation theology. That these are people who realize that we're in a crisis, that things are hopeless, and that therefore they're doing radical, revolutionary, rebellious sort of praxis, action-oriented things that hopefully will help them turn things around. At least it catches our attention, right? Or it's got to, you know, if there's nothing else that my feeble efforts this week to talk about the liberation theology do, at least if we can be aware of the situation that so many people find themselves in and the desperate solutions that that they're trying to use to somehow stop this, what we're calling the inevitable. Okay, now, our assignment again today is not to get into this, that comes later in the week, but today we get back to the exciting thing about reading the Bible. And I want to tell you my agenda so that we'll try to have time to cover all of it. First of all, I'd like to simply ask you to give me some examples of the Bible just off the top of your head. I mean, where the Bible speaks to this whole question of oppression and liberation. Secondly, we'll just take some fairly obvious examples, and since Barbara this week is walking through Luke, and since I assume many of you are going to those sessions, I thought we could also tap into what she's already done for us and just sort of take a look at some other passages, including hers in Luke. Then thirdly, I'd like to take some less obvious examples. For instance, we were sitting in a base Christian community in January in Honduras, and the pastor was preaching on John 2, the sermon of Jesus going to the wedding in Canaan, and never, ever in my life had I ever looked at that from the perspective that this particular pastor looked at it from coming out of liberation theology. But finally, and most important, maybe we should start with this, I'm not sure, is that after we've done all this exercise, we need to ask ourselves, are we manipulating the text? Are they guilty of manipulating the text? looking at it from their own perspective, seeing in it the things that they want to see, and coming up with those answers that they want to come up with. All of us do this. We know we do this. And certainly we can't expect people who are oppressed and poor and suffering to be free of the temptation to do this as well. So we need to ask ourselves that question. And maybe we'll wait till the end. I'll ask it at that point. But we need to save ourselves a little bit of time. After we've done it, let's ask ourselves if we've been honest. Are we really using the text as it's meant to be used, or are we abusing it, misusing it, because we're exploiting it, manipulating it, bringing our own perspective, our own message, and so forth into it. Anyway, that's my agenda. So why don't we begin with the first thing I suggested. Just off the top of your head, we already had an example or two from yesterday, but what examples can you find in the Bible where the Bible seems to be speaking to oppressed people and somehow suggesting that God wants those oppressed people to be liberated? We talked, just to get the ball started, I'll remind you that yesterday somebody brought up the Exodus story, which is a classic example, and it's one of the favorites, of course, that liberation theology always begins with. But beyond that, where do we go?
One of their favorites is Mary's Magnificent.
Uh-huh. Okay, now that's going to be in Luke. It's the first chapter of Luke. And because we're going to try to walk through some of the verses in Luke, we'll hold that. And we'll all do that. And again, the reason I want to use Luke today is because Barbara's already leading some of you in
Luke. Amos is an obvious one.
Amos? Okay, tell us about Amos.
Well, Amos is quite shocked at the kind of extravagance that so many people are exhibiting, and the injustice of the courts and the of the merchants, and everybody is taking it out on the poor, and he's crying for justice.
Mm-hmm. And that famous quote from Amos, "Let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like an ever-flowing stream." Okay, where Amos the prophet is looking at oppressed people, people who are not being treated justly, and he's crying throughout the whole book, screaming that there might be justice, and damning those people who are somehow guilty of oppression. Okay, good example.
Well, the Psalms are just full of cries of crying to the God to save them and deliver them from the oppressors.
All right, great. And often with much hope that it's going to happen. Not only are there Psalms that are filled with lament, but also with rejoicing because God has delivered them from oppression. Okay, other examples?
What about the year of Jubilee?
Yeah, tell us about that. By the way, you realize we're in the Old Testament. You asked about this yesterday. Everything's Old Testament so far. Go ahead.
In the year of Jubilee, then they were not supposed to raise any crops. They were supposed to let things grow naturally to try to help the ecology, I think. And then the slaves were to be freed, and the people that had to sell land, they could get their land back again, that sort of thing.
Yeah. Jubilee, of course, was every 50 years. And exactly as she said, on the 50th year, every time it came around, all land, no landowners again were landowners. Everybody started at scratch, so that anybody that had been poor, let's say somebody had been widowed and had lost her land or whatever, after the 50th year, everything goes back to even Stephen again, and we start off all over again. Now, if in the next 50 years you get poor, you always have that hope, because there's justice, there's concern for the oppressed, that at the end of the Jubilee or the next Jubilee, then everybody would be given equal again. Unbelievable. Capitalism would never grow in that sort of a climate. Okay, you're doing great. What are some other examples?
Well, we've got Jesus' announcement of his ministry.
That's in Luke also, so let's hold
he
that.
He opened the book and found the place where it was written.
Hold it. That's going to be our greatest thing.
Should I be in the Old Testament?
No. I want you to read that, but just wait till we get to Luke. That's going to be beautiful. Okay, that's the fourth chapter of Luke. What are other examples?
In Acts, there are examples of people selling what they had and giving it to everyone holding things in common.
Yeah, in fact, Carol preached about that on Sunday night. And if they didn't, woe be unto you. All right, yeah, the need to be in common, huh?
I'm not sure where this fits, and I don't recall having read much liberation theology that deals with the themes of the book of Revelation, but certainly there's enormous oppression going on there that John is somehow trying to address. I'd be glad for any light you can shed on that. Where does that theme surface much? And how do we look at that?
It's
certainly a situation of oppression.
And the oppression, of course, in the book of John is that the Roman Empire is oppressing the Christians. And in such a way that portions of the book of John or the book of Revelation are calling for God to it's an apocryphal sort of a literature that is calling for God to come and deliver these people from the oppression. By the way, we need to put this in context too, that the Bible, the people in the day of Jesus and Paul in the New Testament and the Old Testament, we've been talking mostly about that. But they had known political oppression, constant political oppression, for almost 600 years. Going way back to the Babylonian exile in about the 6th century B.C., when the Babylonians, I wish we had a map, but we don't, had swept in and conquered most of the Mediterranean world, and had carried most of the people of Israel into captivity across the Arabian desert, and had kept them for, almost 70 years. And had destroyed the city of Jerusalem, and had burned and destroyed the temple, and had taken the kings and all the leadership and so forth. People were absolutely, we talk about oppression. They really knew what it was like then. But anyway, from that point on, the Babylonian captivity, then all of a sudden the Persians conquered the Babylonians. And then after that, I guess it comes the Greeks under Alexander the Great, and then the Assyrians and the Egyptians and the Romans. And you finally get into there's a little break where you have the Maccabean revolt. But then you get into the New Testament period, and the Romans are oppressing all the more. And that brings us to the book of Revelation. So we're talking about people that are living in the Bible times, and the people, especially by the time you get to the New Testament, who have had 600 years of political oppression, and they know what they're talking about. Keep that in mind, because when we talk about the context for the Bible, that says something to us, that these are people who are living in the days that the New Testament, when we get to that, when we read Luke, when the New Testament is being written, who have been an oppressed people for over 600 years. We don't know anything about that. I've never been oppressed. I've never been... this country has never been conquered by anybody. And as a white, male, U.S. citizen, middle class, and so forth, I've never known oppression. I've never been hungry a day in my life, except when the doctor told me a couple weeks ago I had to not eat for a day because he was going to do some tests or something. But, I don't know what it is to be oppressed. But these people do. Keep that in mind when we get to the end of this period, when we start analyzing. Okay, you're doing great. Some other examples?
The Beatitudes certainly speak to the oppressed.
Say that again.
The Beatitudes certainly speak
and to the oppressed. We're going to get some of those Beatitudes when we get to Luke also. Luke is amazing. It covers just about everything. So,
Luke 6.
Yeah, okay. Yeah, we'll pick those up. The Sermon on the... the Sermon on the Plain, I was going to say, instead of the Sermon on the Mount. All right. Lest we run out of time, unless you have some other examples that come off the top of your head, maybe it'd be a good idea to sit down, take a look. I'll sit down. You can stand up if you want to. But, we'll look at the book of Luke and just sort of skim through and pull out some of those very obvious passages that are just going to jump out and hit you right between the eyes. And so I've had to squelch some of you because you want to say it. You know they're there. And we might as well take a look at them. Unless anybody has any other examples. Anybody? Okay, let's begin with the first chapter of Luke. And just simply see what happens to be there. Somebody said something about the Magnificat. By the way, I've got to find the Gospel of Luke here. Okay, so we're in the first chapter. And let's just sort of remind ourselves very quickly of what's going on in the first chapter of Luke. It's the Christmas story that most of you are familiar with. And in the first chapter, the 26th verse, 27th verse, a virgin comes to Joseph, the house of David, and to Mary. And he came and said, "Hail, O favored one." Do you see where we are? the Lord is with you, and announces to Mary that she's going to have a baby, who's going to be a very special sort of a baby person. And after, okay, then Mary's going to make her little proclamation, which begins in the 46th verse. So somebody read that for us, okay? And the rest of you now interrupt and jump out and scream if you hear anything at all that sounds like liberation theology. Okay, go ahead.
And Mary said, "My soul magnifies the Lord, and my spirit rejoices in God my Savior, for he has regarded the low estate of his handmaiden."
Okay, stop right there. What's that saying? Who was Mary? If you were God and you were planning to become incarnate, would you go to somebody of low estate, or wouldn't you go to the daughter of the President of the United States, or at least the daughter of the President of the bank or something? You know, somebody that had some clout and some importance in the community. But instead, God goes to, or the angel goes to, Mary, a person of low estate. I don't know if any of you have read Roland Bainton's little sermons from Luther on Mary, but Luther just paints this so vividly, that Mary is an absolute nobody. She's probably a 14 or 15-year-old peasant girl who has no standing, social standing whatsoever. Why in the world God would have chosen her to be the mother of Jesus is just hard for us to believe. In fact, how does the little saying go? How odd of God to choose the Jews? Even that Mary was a Jew, you know, put it in that context. We've got an unbelievable situation. But okay, go ahead. Keep
for
reading.
"For behold, henceforth all generations will call me blessed, for he who is mighty has done great things for me, and holy is his name, and his mercy is on those who fear him from generation to generation. He has shown strength with his arm. He has scattered the proud in the imagination of their hearts."
Okay, now we're getting powerful. Did you hear what you said? He scatters the proud. Keep going.
"He has put down the mighty from their thrones."
And if you're a poor, oppressed person, what do you think you're doing? You're going wild with delight, right? Go ahead.
"And exalted those of low degree. He has filled the hungry with good things, and the rich he has sent empty away."
What's that sending the rich away empty? What does that illustrate on our chart on the bottom half? You probably don't remember. That was the toughest one of all. But that's existentialism. God favors the poor, says liberation theology. God is on the side of the poor. He's exalting the lowly, and the rich he is sending away empty. God's on our side. And the poor people are reading this in Latin America and wherever else. And they are becoming absolutely delirious with what the Bible is telling them. It's there. It's just right in front of you. You can't, anybody can understand these words. Okay, we could just keep reading, but I think we've hit the heart of it right there. All right, jump on now, still in the same first chapter. In the meantime, Elizabeth, Mary's, cousin, has had her baby. What's her baby's name?
John.
Okay, so Mary has had, or Elizabeth has had John, and John the Baptist comes, and now Zechariah, the father of John the Baptist and the husband of Elizabeth, does his little speech. It's not quite so powerful, but somebody pick it up on, well, go ahead and start with the 67th verse and start reading. Anybody?
"And his father Zechariah was filled with the Holy Spirit and prophesied, saying, Blessed be the Lord God of Israel, for he has visited and redeemed his people, and has raised up a horn of salvation for us in the house of his servant David, as he spoke by the mouth of his old holy prophets from of old."
Okay, and when we talk about that raised up a horn of salvation for us, don't just think of that now in the context of being saved, that is, from because of your sin and quote-unquote going to heaven. But they think in context also of this 600 years of oppression by one country after another. God is sending somebody who's going to save us, deliver us, redeem us. Okay, keep going.
"That we should be saved from our enemies and from the hand of all who hate us."
Oh, there he's saying it right there, okay?
"To perform the mercy promised to our fathers and to remember his holy covenant, the oath which he swore to our father Abraham, to grant us that we, being delivered from the hand of our enemies, might serve him without fear.
Okay, let's just stop and reflect on that. We've already talked about how the people of Israel, the children of Israel, have had 600 years of enemies oppressing them. Who's been the enemy of women when women become a part of liberation theology? Men. Who's been the enemy of blacks for 350 years? Thousands of years for women. But 350 years in America? Whites, of course, have oppressed black. Somebody was talking about Native Americans. Whites again have oppressed, broken over 400 treaties that we've signed with the Native Americans in the last 400 years. Gays again, for thousands and thousands of years, have been oppressed. And on we go. Jews, that's right. But again, if you're like me, when I read these texts, until I got into liberation theology, I never thought of those things because I'm not oppressed. I don't know what it is to not have rights, not have power, not to be a person, to be marginal. And I think I'm being cheated. There's again that contraries from our theme at Holden this summer, that maybe we need to be oppressed to be able to celebrate the good news of the gospel, because that's what they're talking about here, the good news that God is coming, that Jesus is coming, and the message that he's going to bring. I talk too much, and I don't mean to do that, but let's go on some more. No, let's move on. We've got to let's get Jesus' birth, you know, that old birth story that we read every single Christmas. Second chapter now, and let's just pick it up in the 6th and 7th verses. Go ahead, somebody read that. 6th and 7th of the second chapter.
And while they were there, the time came for her to be delivered, and she gave birth to her firstborn son and wrapped him in swaddling clothes and laid him in a manger because there was no place for them in the inn.
Okay, stop there. And what if you were an oppressed person, what joy and satisfaction would you find in those two verses?
There's probably no place for them.
Right.
They're born there.
That's right.
No real shelter.
Right. Okay, talk more about the obvious in that passage.
He's one of us.
Okay.
He's one of our kind.
Right. And where again is he born? Yeah, not in a fancy hospital, not in a king's palace or a mayor's home or the president of the bank's nice place to live, but in a manger. And reminder, we've got a farmer here with us. Tell us what a manger is, if we even have mangers anymore. They smell of manure, right? And there are bugs crawling all over in the straw or whatever else. You know, make it graphic.
And it's a feed box.
It's a feed box, that's right.
They don't smell that.
That's right. Okay, now, next step. At the bottom of the page for me, if you've got it, maybe we're all in the same text. But when we get down to the 15th verse, who are going to be the people that are going to come and celebrate the coming of this new kid on the block? The shepherds in Luke. It's the wise men, I think, in Matthew's first story. But we're in Luke, so we're going to have the shepherds. And tell me about shepherds. What do you know about shepherds? It's probably been a long time since you've talked to one, but go ahead.
They herd sheep.
All right. And?
They're poor.
They're poor. And if we talk about non-persons, do you know where shepherds go to take care of their sheep? Do they come home every night to the lodge and tank up and then go out again in the morning? They'll be gone for months at a time. You won't see them. They're up in the mountains or wherever it is that they need to take their sheep day after day to find green grass, like the 23rd Psalm says, cool water, clear water, and green grass to feed and so forth. So they're non-persons. We don't even see them in our communities. And not only that, but they've got bad reputations, which I wasn't even aware of until one of my colleagues was preaching on this just a few months ago. But evidently, shepherds were considered some of the lowest of low people because their sexual mores, it was suggested, and evidently was at least partially true, was such that not having sexual life, because they're out doing what they're doing for months and months and months at a time, that they would have intercourse with sheep and all of this sort of thing. So that according to the people who knew in that day about shepherds, nothing could be more low or base or disgusting than a shepherd. And who is it now that comes to celebrate the birth of Jesus? The shepherds. These nobodies, these non-persons, the wretched of the earth. And I don't understand that. But somebody down in Guatemala or Nicaragua, where they also have shepherds and who they're also poor and where they also have mangers and so forth, they'll understand it. But I don't. Okay, let's keep going. And I want to encourage you to talk even though I'm not letting you. Let's turn to the third chapter, where John the Baptist is alive now. And third chapter, the 10th through the 14th verse, somebody read those verses.
And the multitude asked him, "What then shall we do?" And he answered them, "He who has two coats, let him share with him who has none. And he who has food, let him do likewise."
Let me interrupt you for a second. We got to put John the Baptist in context. Remember, he's come now. He started to preach, and he's doing his thing. And the people are really impressed. He's this brash, loud, mouthy sort of guy that's strong and doesn't flinch at anybody. And after he's preached one of his little sermons of fire and brimstone, the multitudes ask him, "What are we supposed to do?" And here's what he's telling them, just like he said. "If you've got two coats, give one away. If you've got food, share it." Okay, keep reading.
"Tax collectors also came to be baptized and said to him, 'Teacher, what shall we do?'"
Now, wait a minute. What did Barbara say about tax collectors? Anybody go to a Barbara session and remember what she said about tax collectors? Who are they?
Real crooks.
They're the crooks. They're the hated, most hated of all. You know, they're right there in the same category as shepherds. In fact, Barbara compared him in our society today like a crack dealer, right? You don't even want to be around these people.
IRS,
okay. So anyway, go ahead.
I don't think she thought that.
No, that's right. She said that's
the IRS are that's good right. compared to.
Yeah. Okay. Okay, so we've got tax collectors, and keep going now on the 12th verse. I won't interrupt anymore.
"Tax collectors also came to be baptized and said to him, 'Teacher, what shall we do?' And he said to them, 'Collect no more than is appointed you.' Soldiers also asked him, 'And we, what shall we do?' And he said to them, 'Rob no one by violence or by false accusation, and be content with your wages.'"
Okay, now we don't have soldiers running around, so this is kind of strange for us too, but keep in mind that in Israel, of course, when Luke is writing this, they had had 600 years of soldiers controlling their country. And if I can focus you in on Central America again, there for 400 years, ever since the 16th century. Well, you tell me, what happened in the 16th century in Central America? South America, Central America, Mexico. What all of a sudden happened in the 16th century? Who came? The Spanish. Before that, we had in those Latin American countries some fairly, it wasn't utopia, but we had some fairly sophisticated lifestyles, some science that was amazing. And they have pyramids, of course, and insights on medicines and all sorts of things. They did some child sacrificing and so forth also, so nothing was perfect, like I say, but they were sailing along pretty nice, until all of a sudden the 16th century brings the Spanish. And with the coming of the Spanish, and for now the last 400 years, life in Latin America, South, Central, and Mexico, has been dominated by three power groups. What are those three power groups? What do you think they are? And we just talked about one.
Catholic Church.
Okay, right. That's the surpriser, I suppose. But the church, because the church is going to come with who?
The Spanish.
Well, the Spanish. They're going to be Spanish priests. It's going to be the Spanish church, right? But who's going? And here's all the people in here. They're all sort of like a corral, if we can use a farm image again. and all the people, the powerless, the non-persons, the marginal, the wretched of the earth, the exploited, all of these oppressed people, they're inside of this triangle being held in by three powers. Who are they? The church?
Army.
The military. Okay, there's the army, and that's picking up on our text that we just read.
Government?
No, not the government. That's interesting. To this day, the government really doesn't make that much difference in Central America. It doesn't make any difference who's in government, because these three power structures are going to continue to control the people. The church, the military.
The wealthy landowners?
Yes, the oligarchy. Okay, the wealthy landowners. We'll just put wealth. For instance, Jackie told me that she's going to El Salvador in August. I'm not sure for how long. But El Salvador, for instance, is ruled by 14 wealthy families. 14 families. Those families, in turn, control the military. Doesn't make any difference who's really in government. And those families also control the church, except the church has been split in the last couple decades. How or why? Explain that one to me.
Different groups.
What groups?
Liberal theologians.
This is right. This is the established church, and it's still true to this day in all of these Central American countries, that the established church is in favor, has power. They along with the military and the wealthy, are in control. But these people, the liberation Christians, the base Christian communities, you know, they're inside the liberation theologians and the liberation and the base Christian communities. So the church is literally fighting itself. It's being torn apart by this internal struggle. But the reason I wanted to put this on the board was just simply to remind you that we don't understand this passage. When John the Baptist is talking about, or I don't understand it, or maybe some of you do, when John the Baptist is talking about, what are you going to do with those soldiers who keep coming around abusing you? What are the things he said that they used to do? Soldiers don't keep robbing and using violence and false accusations. Be content with your wages. See, we don't understand that. Do we? Tell me if you do. Because I've never had soldiers pushing me around or being violent to me. But in Central America, they understand. They can read this passage, and this jumps out and hits them. Because they've known for 400 years what it is to be ruled by death squads and military, and to have to send your son off to school one morning and he never returns because he's been introduced into the military. And you'll never see him again. He doesn't want to be fighting, but he is. He has no choice. Okay, well anyway, I guess the point I'm trying to make is that these people read these verses and it's got to do something to them, right? Say right.
Yeah.
Okay. All right. Let's jump on. Now we're getting to Jesus is in the synagogue. John the Baptist has been born and has started his ministry. And next chapter, we have Jesus starting his ministry. And now we are going to have the most famous passage of all read. Go ahead. We're in the fourth chapter, and we begin with the 18th verse. And Jesus has gone into, this is actually the very first thing that Jesus does. He's gone through the wilderness experience, being tempted by the devil, and now he's ready to begin his ministry. And so go ahead and read that to us.
And he stood up to read, and there was given to him the book of the prophet Isaiah. He opened the book and found the place where it was written, "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he has anointed me to preach good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim release to the captives and recovering of sight to the blind, to set at liberty those who are oppressed, to proclaim the acceptable year of the Lord."
Okay, I'm going to keep my mouth shut and you all comment. What does that say? This is, go ahead, what does it say?
The good news is for the poor and the oppressed and the captives and the blind.
Yeah.
And he's declaring the year of Jubilee.
Yeah, what else can it mean?
The acceptable year of the Lord.
Yeah.
He's calling forth an old word from Isaiah.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Yeah, this is biblical. This is Old Testament. And what is so significant about this? Is this just another passage, or does this particular passage have perhaps even more meaning than some other passages might? You know, in its context. What's the context?
He's saying it's here, yeah.
And
this is his proclamation of how he's beginning his ministry.
Yeah.
What his ministry is all about. He's right here.
Right at the beginning. Here's what I'm all about. He reads it, and then what does he do? Closes the book and sits down. And then if you go, well, go ahead, talk about it a little bit more.
Well, we don't want to hear that, so we threw him out.
That's right, exactly. So you get to the end of the chapter, and the people in Nazareth don't want to hear this, especially from this kid, because he's from Nazareth. He's one of our kin. We know this kid. Who is he talking about this stuff? And what is he talking about this kind of stuff? He's talking about being subversive. And all this kind of stuff that we don't like, that we're uncomfortable with.
Man, I agree. But he has ushered in this new radical way.
That's right. And closes the book, and they kick him out of town. They want to throw him off the mountain because this is controversial. And we have to assume, I suppose, that the most of the people who are hearing it again are the comfortable. Who have lots to lose, just like I do. So that's why it's so hard for me to say yes to this, and why I resist it with every fiber that I have, because it means giving up some of my power and giving up some of my excesses that I have. Okay. Well, speak more about this.
A comment. It seems to me that it's not so much these words that he quotes from Isaiah that are off-putting to people, because... we read in verse 22 or so that all spoke well of him and wondered at the gracious words which proceeded out of his mouth. It's only when he moves on in the next segment to personally implicate the hearers.
Yeah, there's a lot of that. You're right.
Then they say, now I understand. He's talking about me. Now I'm ready to drive him out. So there's an important transition of thought there.
That's right.
That as long as you can stay distant from it, that's wonderful, eloquent talk. Then when I identify myself in the middle, then I get uncomfortable.
Yeah, correct.
The preaching started meddling.
Right.
Yeah, right.
Yeah.
Okay, thank you for that. That's a very important and very true distinction we have to make. So it's not just because he said these words, it's what he said afterwards that really seems to get under their skin. Okay, so we've got Jesus in the synagogue. We're still in the fourth chapter. Let's... turn to what happens after that, verse 31, and I guess we won't read that, but just note in that paragraph that begins with the 31st verse that he heals now people with unclean with an unclean demons, a person with an unclean demon. The next paragraph, with verse 38, he heals Simon's mother-in-law, ill with a high fever. The next paragraph, beginning with the 40th verse, he heals people who are sick with various diseases, and people bring them to him. And we're talking about people again in Central America, where the water is so filthy. When you go to Central America next time with the Center for Global Education or whoever they send you or whoever you go with, and you go into these villages where there's absolutely no sanitation, absolutely no water to drink that is drinkable, just a little pond that's filled with scum and all sorts of undesirable things. And kids don't live. If kids make it through the first 5 years of their life, it's almost a miracle. In one little place where we were in El Salvador, there's a Lutheran van, medical van, that comes around every 2 weeks, but you had to walk about 5 miles to even get to it. We don't know what it is, again, to be sick in that sense, because we're one of the... certainly not the most healthy nation in the world anymore. We've slipped quite a bit, I guess. But, for us to give birth to children, we sort of expect it's going to happen in a healthy manner, and that the kids are going to live, and we're surprised, startled, find almost unbelief if it doesn't work out that way. But in Jesus' day, and in places like Central America, it's just the opposite. And whereas we live to be 70, 80, or whatever we do, if you live to be 40 or 50 there, you're an old person. Okay, so anyway, the fact that Jesus comes to the sick who are oppressed and offers healing is another one of those beautiful sort of things that jumps out and hits them. Okay, let's jump down to... let's take what Barbara took, and we're going to run out of time if we don't. Let's jump down to what Barbara talked about yesterday in her Bible study. Luke 5, 27 to 32. 5, 27 to 32. Okay, and by the way, I had nothing to do with Barbara's selection. I had no idea what she was planning to talk about, but it's there. You can't get away from it. Somebody read 5:27 to 32.
After this he went out and saw a tax collector named Levi sitting at the tax office. And he said to him, "Follow me." And he left everything and rose and followed him. How far? 33?
Yeah, keep going.
And the Lord, and Levi made him a great feast in his house. And there was a large company of tax collectors and others sitting at table.
Okay, and remember now, don't forget what a tax collector is, the filthiest of filth, you know, the worst of the worst. Okay, go ahead.
And the Pharisees and their scribes murmured against his disciples.
Okay, let me stop you once again. Today, Barbara said, who are the Pharisees? Who? Me. I'm a Pharisee. You. You know, the nice, comfortable Christians who go to church every Sunday and wear the nice clothes and associate with the right people, the good people. So we're, you know, and it's, if you're down there in Central America and you're looking up here at wealthy North America, USA, you're thinking those are the Pharisees up there. But go ahead as you read this. Keep going.
And the Pharisees and their scribes murmured against his disciples, saying, "Why do you eat and drink with the tax collectors and sinners?" And Jesus answered them, "Those who are well have no need of a physician, but those who are sick. I have not come to call the righteous, but sinners to repentance."
Okay, and again, if I am the non-person, the exploited, the wretched of the earth, what could be more beautiful to know that than to know that Jesus wants to come to my house to eat with me, and that those snotty, wealthy, rich people, such as us, I suppose, are not the ones that he has chosen to go to. We're going to look down, and we're going to look down our noses, and we're going to complain. Okay, now let's get to the so-called Sermon on the Plain, the Beatitudes. Who was it that suggested that as one of our readings? Okay, great. It's sixth chapter. We're going to skip a... Well, okay, we're already in the sixth, I guess. Except notice the way the sixth chapter begins. On a Sabbath. All these things that Jesus is going to do in the sixth chapter happen on a Sabbath. What's the significance of that? And he's going to heal people and he's going to do all these things. But what's the significance of that on the Sabbath?
Day of rest, no work to be done.
That's right. And people that are oppressed are always under laws and rules. You can't do this, you can't do that, and so forth. So the fact that Jesus is doing some of these things, breaking some rules, makes this whole sixth chapter just that much more significant. Okay, and especially now when we get to the so-called, what's equivalent to the Sermon on the Mount, but now it's in Luke, the sixth chapter, the 17th through the 26th verse, and go ahead, Dwayne, read that for us.
And he came down with them and stood on a level place with a great crowd of his disciples and a great multitude of people from all Judea and Jerusalem and the seacoast of Tyre and Sidon who came to hear him and to be healed of their diseases. And those who were troubled with unclean spirits were cured. And all the crowd sought to touch him, for power came forth from him and healed them all. And he lifted up his eyes on his disciples and said, "Blessed are you poor, for yours is the kingdom of God. Blessed are you that hunger now, for you shall be satisfied."
Are you all perking up and are tingles going up and down your spines? Are you hearing what's being read? Okay, go ahead.
"Blessed are you that weep now, for you shall laugh. Blessed are you when men hate you, and when they exclude you and revile you and cast out your name as evil on account of the Son of Man. Rejoice in that day and leap for joy, for behold, your reward is great in heaven, for so their fathers did to the prophets. But woe to you that are rich, for you have received your consolation. Woe to you that are full now, for you shall hunger."
Okay, you've probably hit the height of it and we're running out of time. You get the idea. How could it be clearer? And have you ever in your life, or you probably have, because you're probably much more insightful than I have, but have you ever read these passages before from this particular perspective? Have you thought of them? It's maybe impossible because if you're like me, you're not poor, you're not oppressed, except if you're a woman or something of this sort. But if we can again try to put ourselves into the shoes of those people who know what it means to be oppressed, then all of a sudden, and again, now go back to the fact that we're in these base Christian communities. They hadn't even been allowed to read the Bible before Vatican II, so that in the last couple decades since Vatican II, which was 1962 to 1965, so we've got just a little over a couple decades, for some of the first times people are opening Bibles, reading them. They'd never heard these stories before, perhaps. And again, the beauty of it, to see little kids reading it to them, the whole scenario is just absolutely breathtaking, because I can't read, I'm an adult, but my child can. And all, who again, a child is normally the oppressed, the poor, the non-person. But all of these things are taking place, and the excitement, the exhilaration, you know, the hope. No wonder I can look at it and say it's hopeless, but they can look at it, supported by these kind of texts, and say, there's got to be, God's on our side. God's against the rich. God's supporting us and wanting to deliver us, liberate us, and they're marching on. It's just absolutely unbelievable.
Well, I think even the Catholics in our country are thrilled by the opportunity to do this Bible.
Yeah.
Because it's changing lives.
That's right. And women are participating.
Yes.
In the Roman Catholic Church, even in the distribution of the elements. Uh-huh.
Yeah, you're right. I, in the third state, that worked from farm to farm, and stayed with the farm family every day. And many of those were Catholics, and they were not allowed to have the Bible at that time.
And they're very excited
now. Now, not all Catholics were that way, but in this particular...
So heavily, but I get time conscious now, and I wanted to make sure we got it. Now, what I wanted to do was to take... These are obvious texts, right? You know, can anybody say that the text is really saying... I guess that's the question we've got to ask. Are we exploiting the text? Are we imposing certain views on it that we shouldn't be? But I think, and we're going to come to that next, but I think that it ought to be fairly obvious that this particular text, these texts that we've read, seem to be just saying it in black and white. There doesn't seem to be too much controversy, although that's up for grabs. Right.
The agent of the... action, for instance, in the Magnificat, uh-huh. is God. That is the agent, the one who will bring this this strength and who exalts those of low degree and all this,
uh-huh.
Is, you know, Mary says that this is the Lord.
Uh-huh.
And I'm wondering about the leap to take that action, you know, personally make that your cause, or...
I'd add one thing to that.
Yeah.
In the Magnificat, it's already an accomplished fact. God has done these things. The rich are already stripped of their riches. The humble are already exalted. It's not future tense. It's not that these things are about to happen. It's an accomplished fact.
Because Mary is the mother of Jesus and the shepherds are coming to rejoice. Is that what you mean?
No, I'm saying in the Magnificat, what Mary is reworking from the Song of Hannah in the Old Testament is a statement of these things are already accomplished in the power of God. Not to sit and wait because this is about to break upon you, but it's present tense accomplished language. So it's, you know, same point, I guess, that God is the agent. It's not... Well,
I don't think there's any disagreement, because that's what this existentialism again is referring to, that God is the agent who is working with us. God is on our side. This is bigger than all of us, just as it was bigger than Mary. Mary can't understand it. She marvels, but God's at work, and this is what liberation theologians are saying too, if we're communicating.
I don't understand.
By the way, it's time to cover up, turn your watches upside down.
You say that God is on our side, because if these texts jump out at us, it makes me feel uncomfortable, because I think I'm on the wrong side.
Yeah.
So, can you be on both sides at once? That would be kind of nice.
See, that's why this is so extremely controversial, and why, especially me, I'm even more on the wrong side. You know, well, maybe you're in the same boat that I am. Because I'm white, I'm middle class, I'm comfortable, I'm from the USA, and all these kind of things, and I'm male, you know. And therefore, liberation theology has a way of saying that there's sort of an exclusiveness. There's a preferentialness that makes those of us who aren't poor uncomfortable. And that's one of the things we've got to struggle with. That's one of the things, I literally cry over this as I've agonized. Every time I go down to Central America, I can't control myself. I keep asking myself that same question. What does this mean for me? What am I supposed to do? And I don't know if any of you saw the Bill Moyers three series that he did, one of which was on Central America. Unfortunately, we don't have it here. But he did it about a year or two ago. There was a Methodist pastor in that series, and I met him this last time when I went down, who came to the conclusion that what, and he was teaching in a Methodist seminary. He had lots of prestige, lots of power, lots of clout, but he came to the conclusion that what he had to do was to give it all up and to go to Nicaragua and to live with the poor. He took a vow of poverty. He even had to leave his wife, or his wife left him. I don't know how that worked, because she wasn't willing to do that. He now lives in a little village out in the countryside in Nicaragua, helping the poor, doing what the poor does, and the man has come alive. You just got to find that Bill Moyers thing and see that. It's have you seen it, and are you? Yeah, this guy is kind of glows like Mother Teresa or St. Francis of Assisi. And I don't know what it means either. I don't want to go that far. See, I don't want to give up my ice cream and my comfort and my power. And I'm not giving any easy answers. I don't know if that's what it means to do, but that's what one guy did. Go ahead.
You mentioned St. Francis, and I'm wondering, did this liberation theology not actually come to birth in many eras of the past, like St. Francis? Kagawa, Japan, Schweitzer, Africa, and many long before. And I just wonder if their interpretations weren't also closely akin to this.
Sure. And what's going on with Tutu in South Africa is very similar. You get constant patterns that are so similar. But again, we go back to that same existential question. Do I have to be a black oppressed person in South Africa to know what it means to be liberated? What does it mean for me? And I don't have any easy answers. All I know is I literally choke up and I squirm and I have to keep going back, because it's such an important question. I just have to wrestle with it. And I'm getting ready to cry right now. Go ahead.
Well, I think if we were hearing this for the first time, we can stop and think how that would be. We're so used to it, you know, we sort of accept it. As a matter of fact, this has been given to us all our lives, and it is important.
Yeah.
When you read it with new eyes,
it's exactly.
I can get just as excited as anyone.
Yeah. Which, if you don't mind, I'm going to read a brief paragraph from Robert McAfee Brown, which is going to conclude it now, and it's going to ask that very question. Are we being legitimate in reading the Bible the way we are? Because there's a real danger, again, that we can be imposing something on this or not seeing something that we should. But let me just simply share this with you, because I think he's saying exactly what we've been talking about. And I want you to agree or disagree with him. The history of biblical interpretation is notorious for the degree to which its readers highlight those portions that buttress their own social philosophy, and we filter out those portions that challenge our own point of view. All of us do this, frequently unaware of what we are doing, so it is important to have our latent presuppositions exposed. And that's what I'm saying we've got to do too. I read the Bible from the position of the oppressor and the wealthy, and they're reading it from the position of the oppressed and the poor. Okay, now he goes on. One could almost assume that the Bible read by liberation theologians and the Bible read by middle-class Christians in America were two different messages. When North Americans encounter third world biblical interpretation, they are likely to react, "Those people are biased. their own situation conditions their reading of Scripture, right? Aren't we likely to do that? Such a charge, says Brown, is appropriate only if it continues, and so are we biased, and so are we conditioned. Anyway, nobody approaches Scripture de novo. We bring things to the reading as well as drawing things from the reading. But it is not enough to say they read it one way, we read it another. End of discussion. And here's the corker now. Here's the one I want you to wrestle with. For one way of reading may be closer to the actual meaning than another. And which way do you suppose he's going to suggest is closer to the real meaning than the other? Our way of reading it or their way of reading it? Their way of reading it. They know what it means because the Bible was written by people who knew what it means to be oppressed. Let me go on, then I'll finish. They, when liberation theologians talk about this, you know, what we're talking about, they mean that there is a privileged or advantageous way of understanding the Bible that is granted to the struggling poor and denied to the rich. Because the struggling poor are closer to the situation of the biblical writers than are the rich. Most of the biblical writers were themselves oppressed, writing to the oppressed in situations of oppression. Those in similar situations today are likely to have better understanding. Can I read that? Yeah, those who are in similar situations today are likely to have a better understanding of what the biblical writers are saying than those of us in very different situations, since they are attuned to the biblical message in ways that we are not. If the message is a good news to the poor are likely to hear it affirmatively, while the rich look for ways to avoid the message. And take me as an example. I fought to avoid it with all my heart, to push it aside, to sweep it under the carpet. But you just can't do it. Well, react. React to what we just read from Robert McAfee Brown, and react to, if you have time. Just, you're free to go. It's time to go.
In the 19th century, we sent out the missionary movement, mm-hmm. and to places of the poor and so on. And I'm wondering how much it's true that we did send it as an opiate of the masses. We did give it the otherworldly interpretation. We did say this is the way to run away from all and that and think of heaven and the pearly gates and so on. And it seems to me that we're doing the same thing today, and that the this message out to Latin America in a kind of otherworldly way. The end of the world is about to come, and so get on it and run away from all this.
Come again on Friday, because that's exactly what our topic is then. That's exactly what the fundamentalist Pentecostals are doing in Central America, for instance, offering people pie in the sky by and by. In other words, when you die, then you're going to get your reward. And they're diametrically opposed to liberation theologians who are saying, we want to help your position. We want to eliminate your oppression now. And again, both are growing fast and furiously, but maybe your message that you just taught, and that's not your message, I don't think, but the message you just suggested is growing even faster. People who haven't caught the hope of liberation theology, people who are so discouraged, are grabbing for the Christian faith, saying, well, if I can't have it now, at least I'll get my reward when I go to heaven. And what I said yesterday was accurate. 400 conversions every hour to the Pentecostal fundamentalist faith. Just unbelievable growth in Central America.
Mm-hmm. Comment made over there about history. History is repeating itself, I feel, and I'm not so sure that I can see much difference between this liberation theology and what has happened in the past. For example, the Russian Revolution. The people that revolted were oppressed. They had leaders. First was Engels, then Marx, then Lenin, then Stalin. And out of that group, I forget how many were in the early stages theologians. they threw it out. They said theology is of no value. It hasn't worked. It doesn't work. It won't work. And in fact, they said what somebody commented here, that it was the opiate of the people. So what is going to be different here? Then we can go back to our own history, the American Revolution. It was a flight from oppression in Europe. And the beginnings of our country were based, the political struggles were based largely on a Christian perspective of freedom from this oppression. Have we overcome it? Apparently not, you see. So if this group succeeds, will they fall into the same pattern that we are in now? In other words, if the oppressed are the favored of God, if their struggle succeeds and they get out of this oppression, then they're no longer the oppressed. Then they have eliminated themselves from God's favor. Mm-hmm. You see what I'm getting at?
Yeah.
It's a, I would believe it's a continuing process. If you look back at Exodus, when the Jews were freed from oppression, and then as soon as they became a landed people,
exactly right,
they began to oppress.
They did it all again. They had kings.
And so this our pilgrim forefathers who were oppressed in England came over and immediately started oppressing
Native
Americans and each other. If you were a Baptist, you couldn't stay in Massachusetts. That's where we got Rogues Island, because Roger Williams was a Baptist, and they kicked him out of Massachusetts because that was congregational, and said, you can't live with us, etc., etc. It's just one story after another.
So what is the difference?
Well, there would be people who over the years, over the centuries, I guess, who have been faithful to do it.
Yes.
I guess the Mennonites come pretty close to it.
I have other thoughts too, and won't take time now, but what's different about this liberation theology, the present system versus some of the past? And if this succeeds in quote, how long before it again breaks down and we have to start over? It's a continuing process. It's part of humanity's struggle.
And have you already answered your own question? Or does somebody else want to answer?
That's my answer.
Yeah, anybody else want to jump in?
In other words, this is not the ultimate.
Yeah. If what we said when we took the Eucharist the other night and began by confessing our sins, if that's true, if we're all sinners, I'm afraid we might have a future such as you're suggesting. That as long as I'm oppressed, I'm going to be celebrating the good news of a God who comes to relieve my oppression. But then somehow when I become comfortable, when I become powerful, then somehow I tend to forget that. I think only of myself, and all of a sudden I fall into that same pattern of oppressing others. So maybe we'll never be able to get along without liberation theology. It's just because of the nature of the beast.
It's certainly not an answer to that, but what I've read of the feminist response with this, feminists might suggest that connectedness is an idealistic part of the solution, that once we realize that we are one earth and one people, that maybe that's the beginning of the end of the cycle.
Yeah.
But that can be seen as very idealistic too.
Yeah. In fact, just like we began today when we were talking about the environment, maybe it's going to take something unbelievably tragic like this to bring us to our senses. One of the newest, and really, I'm just starting to read it, but one of the newest, and really, I think, quite well done books on liberation theology is entitled, The Good News is the Bad News, which is the Good News. And maybe it takes an environmental crisis, that bad news, to bring us back to the good news again. And we just keep going in a cycle. That we've got to be roughed up, you know, slapped and say, thanks, I needed that, to realize, you know, what has to be done, if I'm making sense.
I wonder if there are any parallel movements in other religions, if anyone knows, and especially Hindi or Muslim religions?
No.
I'm inclined to say no, but yeah, see, most every, this is a generalization again, it's always dangerous, but most every other religion of the world says that the way to get right is somehow through your good works, through pulling yourself up by your bootstraps, through discipline. Whereas the message here, of course, is that good news that God is coming to me in my lowest estate. I'm a low handmaid. I didn't plan it, I didn't ask for it, I didn't work for it, it just came as a gift. That Jesus appears and announces this same good news. It's, you know, it's a gospel. It's a story of grace. And I think in that sense, that Christianity is unique.
Mm-hmm. Another thought, this liberation theology, what is it they are really seeking? I know it's freedom from to getting out from under oppression, but any movement in the past that has searched for liberation from oppression, it has almost always resulted in material gains. So, like in the U.S., we have, in a sense, reached, developed, whatever you want to call it, the material heaven. Mm-hmm. And this is not the ultimate answer.
That's right.
And yet that is really the basis of this liberation theology or any of the past. So it's in the sense that it contains its own seeds of destruction.
That's right. Exactly. And that's one of the great critiques of it, too, that we're talking about material, not totally, of course, but a part of it, of course, is material rather than spiritual wealth.
Well, except that already it has brought not the material, but the spiritual.
Yes.
These exactly. Base Christian communities are places where the Holy Spirit has moved.
That's
where
right.
People who were no people are now people.
That's right.
And where there's a fellowship and a realization,
right.
A fulfillment, like they never dreamed.
And where there's forgiveness. I could tell you stories that are unbelievable about these Christian communities in El Salvador, for instance, where the death squads have gone out into the neighborhoods and have into the rural areas and have killed people left and right indiscriminately for all sorts of reasons that we won't take time to talk about. And how those people have gathered together and have prayed for the forgiveness of those people who have killed their sons, their husbands, stances that I think I could never take, perhaps. If somebody had killed my daughter, raped my wife. But story after story about how, having read the Bible and come to the conclusion that the Bible means that we ought to be a people filled with grace and love and forgiveness, how they're doing it. And that's not just material. That's the real Christian message.
This is part of the process. As soon as the process has achieved its goal, then those things are lost.
Maybe.
And not totally, but I mean, that has kind of been the pattern in history.
Probably so. You all realize that it's a few minutes past our stopping time. You're all free to go.
It's lunchtime, yes.
I love talking with you. This is great.
And the sad part is that the story of great movements is that they cease becoming a movement after 8 or 10 years to become institutionalized in order to continue it. And then they get comfortable like the church and are no longer the church.
Often they'll make it through the first generation. But when you try to transpose it or pass it on to the second generation or the third generation, then you have troubles.